to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. I believe that's Irene Bowden coming in there with some help. That's a surprise. It's a pleasant surprise. Okay, Matthew chapter 22. And if you have your workbooks, we're on page 30. And this is a series of informal debates, confrontations that Jesus had with the various Jewish sects. The last week of his life on earth, as he's teaching in the temple at the early in the morning, and great crowds have come to hear him teach. And so, first of all, there's been a confrontation with the Jewish leaders, who were the chief priests and so forth, who were in charge of the temple, as to by what authority he was teaching. Following that, since he had answered their question concerning authority, then the various sects of the Jews are trying to catch him in his words. So we're going to see the great wisdom of the Lord, but also there's some good practical teaching here. First of all, in Matthew chapter 22, Carolyn, if you'll read for us verses 15 through 22, and then Larry, would you get Mark chapter 12, verses 13 through 17? Mark chapter 12, verses 13 through 17. And Darlene, if you will, Luke chapter 20, verses 20 through 26. All right, so let's begin with Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 through 22.
Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the
Herodians,
saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, "Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money." So they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, "Whose image and inscriptions is this?" They said to him, "Caesar." And he said to them, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." When they had heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way.
Okay, thank you, Carolyn. Then Larry, Mark chapter 12, verses 13 through 17.
Then they sent him some of the Pharisees and
Herodians, to
catch him in his words. When they had come, they said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true and care about no one, for you do not regard the person of men, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, "Why do you test me? Bring me a denarius that I may see it." So they brought it. And he said to them, "Whose image and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." And Jesus answered and said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they marveled at him.
Okay, thank you, Larry. And then, if you will please, Darlene, Luke chapter 20, verses 20 through 26.
So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous, that they might seize on his words in order to deliver him to the power and the authority of the governor. Then they asked him, saying, "Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly, and you do not show favoritism, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But he perceived their craftiness and said to them, "Why do you test me? Show me a denarius. Whose image and inscription does it have?" And they answered and said, "Caesar's." And he said to them, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." But they could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people, and they marveled at his answer and kept silent.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, so that's the three records, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, of Jesus encountering two very different groups of people. One is the disciples of the Pharisees, so not the leaders of the Pharisees that came to Jesus, but their disciples. Why the disciples of the Pharisees instead of the leaders?
Well, they want to stick their own neck out.
I think that's probably it. Instead of risking themselves in the confrontation, where they always come off second best, hadn't they? When they tried to have an argument with the Lord, let the young guys. And also, it may be that you notice Jesus perceived their craftiness. He realized, he knew what they were doing. Of course, we know from John chapter 2 that Jesus knew what was in the hearts of people, so he could always tell what they were trying to do. But it may have been that they thought, well, these young fellows appear to be innocent, and maybe he won't be on his guard and make some unguarded statement with these young fellows. And so we know the Pharisees were always trying to get him, because the Pharisees are the popular party among the Jews. Now, they were the strict from the standpoint of keeping the traditions of the Jews. And the people thought they were righteous, although they were not. And so they were popular among the people. But what's this other group that comes with them to try to ensnare Jesus in his words?
Scribes.
Not the scribes this time, it's a different group. The disciples of the Pharisees, and then another group with them, the Herodians. Now, who are Herodians? This is a new group. We don't. And by the way, from what I read, you don't find anything in the ancient documents of the Jews about the Herodians. Who would the Herodians be?
Supporters of Herod, I'm sure.
Supporters of Herod, of course. And think about this from the standpoint of the queen. Now, by the way, the Herod at this time, there was no Herod over over Judea at this time. The Romans were ruling directly at this time through Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor. And so they didn't have a puppet king as they'd had at other times over Judea. But it appears that there was a group of people that thought the Herods would be the best answer for the people. And so they all, and there's no documents from ancient times to tell us much about them, but obviously they're supporters of Herod. Now, Herod, the so-called Herod the Great, he was not very great, but that's what he was called, died shortly after the birth of Jesus. This is his grandson that was around at this time, Herod Antipas. So apparently these were supporters of Herod Antipas. Now, let me ask you this. How well would Pharisees and supporters of Herod get along?
No.
Not at all. They would absolutely despise each other. So what are these two teaming up together for?
They both had the motive to try to...
What does it take to make friends among politicians?
The same idea, the same motive.
A common enemy.
Yeah, common enemy.
Common enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Isn't that true? In international politics and in domestic politics too. So they're teamed up together because they have a common. They have nothing in common with each other except a common enemy, and that's Jesus. And so they're trying to catch him in his words. Okay. So what question do they pose to Jesus? Shall we pay taxes? Shall we pay the tribute to Caesar or not? Now, you know, this is the one thing the Romans were, they wanted to keep the peace. They didn't want to have any insurrection. They didn't want to have any turmoil. Everything was supposed to be peaceful. Because what happens when things are in turmoil, when there's not peace?
You got a bunch of headaches.
A bunch of headaches is right, and there's a breakdown in tax collection. That's what the Romans wanted to get from all of these outlying places. They wanted to get money. They wanted taxes. They had a system set up. We've talked about this, you know, that Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector when Jesus went through Jericho. You remember that from Luke chapter 19? He'd be a tax collector for the Romans. And what did the people think about that? Do the people like paying taxes to the Romans?
Who does?
Yeah, but it's not just a matter of paying taxes. Now, how many people go, I'll let you hold up your hand if you like to pay taxes. But, you know, we pay taxes to our own government that's elected by the people, right? What if you're having to pay taxes to a foreign power that had conquered you? How much would you like that? And how much did you think of the people that collected the taxes for that foreign power? Okay, so how favorably did the people look upon paying taxes to the Romans? They didn't like that at all. So here you've got the Pharisees. These are the disciples of the Pharisees. They're the popular party. They want the support of the people. And so they know that the people will be opposed to paying taxes to the Pharisees. What's the other group here?
Herodians.
The Herodians. Who would they represent?
Herod.
The government. All right. Now, do you think the Herods were in favor of paying taxes to the Romans?
Sure.
Of course they were. The Herods were puppet rulers for the Romans. Of course they were in favor of paying taxes for the Romans. So, however Jesus answers this question, what's going to happen?
They're not
going to like it. Yeah. If he says, yes, you must pay taxes to Caesar, then what are the people going to say? See, now right now Jesus is very popular among the people. They're coming to hear him teach every morning in the temple. And so they're going to turn against him if he says, yes, pay those taxes to Caesar. But if he says, no, you should not pay taxes to Caesar. Caesar shouldn't be ruling over us. Then what's going to happen to Jesus?
Roman's
government is going to arrest him and try him for insurrection. So from their standpoint, could you give a right answer to that question? That's called a dilemma. You know what a dilemma is? Either answer you give is going to get you in trouble. You can't give an answer that won't get you in trouble. And that's a dilemma. And so they think they've posed a dilemma that Jesus can't meet. Everybody see that? All right. So, what does Jesus tell them to do?
Render unto Caesar.
Well, first of all, before he says to render to Caesar, he says, he employs an object lesson. Bring a denarius. What's a denarius?
It's the coin. Currency at the time.
It's a Roman coin. That's the point. It's a Roman coin. Now, if you live in the United States of America, whose money do you use?
American.
Why don't you use Canadian money here?
Won't spend.
You know, when I lived up in northern New York, it wasn't uncommon at all to have Canadian money come through. I don't get it down here very much, but and some places would take it just because they wanted the business of Canadians. Most places wouldn't take it because in the United States, it's not legal tender, right?
In Michigan, it was taken just like...
Yeah, because there's so many Canadians that trade there.
Discounted.
Yeah, and well, of course, you have to... They had to do that because there's a difference in the value between Canadian money and American money. That's a matter of the exchange rate, as you know, from living up there. But they didn't legally have to do that because in the United States, the legal tender is U.S. money. Now, when I go into Uganda or into Kenya, even though their money is worth a tiny fraction of American money, we have to exchange our American dollars for either Ugandan shillings in Uganda or Kenyan shillings in Kenya because that's legal tender in those countries. Now, what's the point that I'm making here? If a coin is a Roman coin and that's legal tender, who's ruling there?
Romans.
Yeah, that's just the very fact that a Roman coin, a denarius, one day's wages for a common worker in Palestine, The very fact that that's legal tender is proof in and of itself that the Romans are the ones doing the ruling. And the very fact that that fella, that those people had a denarius on them, that they easily produced a denarius, what did that show about them?
That they were agreeing with the Romans.
Yeah, that they were at least going along with Roman rule because they had to in order to have money to spend. Do you think I'm going to go over to Uganda and say, no, I refuse to use Ugandan money. I'm going to use American money I've got with me.
I'm dry.
Actually, you could do that a lot of places because everybody wants American money, but it wouldn't be the right thing to do.
When we went to Vietnam, they took up all our money and they gave us MPC, military payment certificates. That's what we bartered with there.
Yeah.
But if they got a hold of American cash, they got a hold of a gold mine.
Right.
It's so much larger. So they took everything away from us, even our coins. We didn't have coins.
Yeah. That also would have tempted those people to try to mug you and steal from you, wouldn't it, by carrying American currency. That's true everywhere I've been, that people love to get American currency. But nonetheless, when you're there, of course it was a different situation when you were in war in Vietnam, but where I go in peace, I just use their currency. So as soon as we get there, we have to go to a foreign exchange place and exchange our American currency for the local currency and use their currency. But the fact that you use that currency is proof that that government is in control. They're the rulers and you're submitting to them and you're showing your submission to them by using their currency. Is that right or wrong? Now, all that's true, isn't it? Okay. So Jesus had them bring to him a denarius, and whose superscription, the superscription means it stands up above, was on it. Yeah, Tiberius Caesar was the Caesar at that time. The first of the Caesars was Augustus, and he'd been dead for quite some time, and he was followed by Tiberius, and then Tiberius was followed by Nero later on. But at this time, it was Tiberius Caesar, and so there was a picture of Tiberius on that, and then a statement under there to the effect that this is Tiberius. I'm trying to remember. I had a picture of it. I forgot to put it up here for you to see of a Roman denarius. But it had a superscription on it of the divine Tiberius, the son of the divine Augustus Caesar. Of course, you understand they worshiped the Caesars as deity. And so this is what they were spending as money. That proved that they were in submission to them. So how did Jesus answer their question? That now he's produced, or they've produced the coin that demonstrates by the very fact they're using that coin that the Romans are the rulers. Then what did Jesus say?
Render
to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Now, what does that statement imply? First of all, is there a distinction between civil rule and divine rule?
Sure.
Yeah, and in our country we call that separation of
church
and state. But you know, that's not something new with our Constitution. That's something that goes all the way back to Jesus Christ. Let me ask you this. And see, here's the Jewish background. Under the Old Testament, was there a distinction between church and state?
No.
You're right, there was not. It was all one thing. God was the king of Israel. And God was to select the king who would rule in his name. Now that's the way God allowed Saul to be king because that's the kind of king Israel wanted. But then when Saul failed, God chose a man himself after his own heart. Paul says about him in Acts chapter 13. And of course that was David. And David recognized that he wasn't truly the king of Israel. He only ruled in the name of the Lord, and he was the representative of the Lord. But is that the case in modern governments? You know, maybe you know this from European history. They used to talk about the divine right of kings. in European history, and whoever the king was, he was selected by God. Well, they're taking that from Old Testament history. That didn't follow in nations since the first century. Under the reign of Christ, there is a distinction between the church and the state, between civil rule and spiritual rule. Jesus also states that in John chapter 18, verse 36. John chapter, would you get that for us, please, Gene? John chapter 18, verse 36. And then Janet, if you will, Romans chapter 14, verse 17, which is another passage that shows the nature of the kingdom of God. John 18, verse 36, please, Gene.
Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from him."
What does that mean? Now, we know that his kingdom came from above, but that also has to do with the nature of his kingdom. He's giving that statement in reply to a question from Pilate while he's on trial before Pilate. When Pilate said, "Are you a king then?" That question followed this. But Jesus' statement before Pilate, see, Pilate, he was on trial for insurrection. And if he had said, "I'm a king of the Jews," just like David was a king of the Jews, then would he be guilty of insurrection? Yes, he would have. He'd be trying to lead a revolution against the Romans. And that's what the Jews thought he was going to do, is lead a revolution, a rebellion against the Romans. But he wasn't going to do that, was he? And the reason he wasn't is that his kingdom was spiritual in its nature. It's not civil in its nature. A spiritual kingdom is upheld by spiritual power, the power of truth. The kingdom of this world is upheld by armed might. That's the only way a kingdom of this world can exist, is by armed might. Okay, is that making sense to everybody? Okay, and then Janet, Romans 14, 17, please.
"For the kingdom of God is not food and drink, but righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit."
If a fellow runs for office and he promises everybody they're going to have prosperity, you're going to have good jobs, you're going to have everything that you want materially, do you think, now of course assuming folks believed him, do you think you'd get elected? Probably so. You know, that is how politicians run, promising people the things they want, and that's usually material things, right? That's a kingdom of this world. Is that the nature of the kingdom of the Lord? Now, and by the way, folks in denominations, and many of our brethren need to learn that, the social gospel goes around giving folks material things, things that they want to attract, that appeals to their flesh rather than to the spirit. But is that the nature of the Lord's kingdom? No. So this statement that Jesus made implies the nature of the kingdom and that things are changing. Whereas under the Old Testament system, it was a system in which the Lord promised that if they would obey Him and keep His commandments, then He would bless them with all kinds of material things. Very little said about any spiritual blessings under the Old Testament. Bless them with all kinds of material things. But that's not the nature of the Lord's kingdom. It's spirit, all the spiritual blessings in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3. So Jesus gave to them a reply. Now, by the way, let me ask you this. When Jesus said, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's," did that imply that they should have paid the taxes to Caesar? Yes, it did. So do you think that would make the people happy? Might not, but one thing about it, the answer was so obviously true that the people that came to him to entrap him, did they have something they could use against him?
No.
They couldn't use. First of all, he didn't say something that would cause the Romans to arrest him. And what he said was so obviously true on the face of it that it didn't even turn the people against him. Because that nobody could gainsay what he said by the fact that they had that Roman coin. That was proof positive that they were in subjection to the Romans and they ought to be paying their taxes to the Romans instead of leading a rebellion. That should have told the people that Jesus was not going to set up a physical kingdom on this earth, but did that? Did they gain that from what Jesus taught? It seemed okay. All right, anybody have anything further you want to bring up about what Jesus did there? All right, what's the primary point, do you think, that the inspired writers are making in recording this exchange between Jesus here and the Herodians and the disciples of the Pharisees? Well, what I would get from the primary thing is the divine wisdom of Jesus. What would you... Anything else you want to get from that? Any primary point? Joe, anything you want to add to it?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say he was called the master teacher, and this is just another example
yes.
of how he was that.
Yeah, and you know, in this case, he's the master debater, because what this is one of a series of informal debates that Jesus had. One form of debating is where one fellow asks the other one a series of difficult questions and he has to answer them, and then in return, then the other one asks the other one. In fact, I've had 10 public debates, and almost always one of the things that occurred was we submitted to each other a list of questions. And I will tell you, those fellows never submitted to me, and I never submitted to them questions that I thought they could easily answer and not get themselves in trouble. Now, I believe that I did that in order to expose error, but if the other fellow was honest, he's trying to expose what he thought was error in me, wasn't he? But all they were trying to do with Jesus was entrap him in his words. Jeannie?
I think that he was trying to not put himself above the law of the land, too. He was not trying to put himself above the king.
That's a good point, and I agree with that. You know, there was an earlier time, I believe it's Luke chapter 14, where a fella in the audience said, "Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me." What was he trying to make Jesus become?
A judge.
Yeah, a judge, a civil magistrate. And Jesus said, "Man, who made me a judge over you?" That wasn't Jesus. He didn't come here to be a civil magistrate. And so he wasn't going to do it. Now, he went ahead and taught him a lesson concerning covetousness. In other words, he turned to the spiritual side. But he did not come for that purpose. Okay. And you're right. While Jesus was here, he obeyed the law of the land, just as we should obey the law of the land, unless those laws contradict God's laws, Acts chapter 5, verse 29. Okay. Any other good comment, Jeannie? Any other comments or questions anybody have? Okay. If not, then let's turn to the next encounter. And if you have your workbooks, this is on page 31, between Jesus and these Jewish groups. This is a different group. Now, all the various groups are represented in the sects of the Jews, S-E-C-T-S. We know, we've talked about the Pharisees, who they are. I think this is the first time we've run into the Herodians. We've talked about the chief priests. That was not a sect. That was just a ruling class. And the scribes. They were not a sect either. Most of the scribes were of the Pharisees. But the scribes were the copyists and the teachers of the law. And they've all had ways that they've tried to entrap Jesus. Now, we have another group coming to Jesus in Matthew 22, beginning in verse 23. Lynn, would you mind reading for us, please? Matthew 22, verses 23 through 33. Matthew 22, verses 23 through 33. Joe, would you get Mark 12, verses 18 through 27? And Victor, if you will, Luke chapter 20, verses 27 through 39. Okay, so this is the third encounter. This is the Sadducees now coming to Jesus. All right, Matthew chapter 22, verses 23 through 33.
The same day Sadducees came to him, who say that there is no resurrection. And they asked him a question, saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and bring up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died,
and having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. Sold to the second and third, down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her. But Jesus answered them, "You are wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for..." Hold on now, I went too far. "And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living." And when the crowd heard this, they were astonished at his teaching.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. All right, Joe, if you will, Mark chapter 12, verses 18 through 27.
Then some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him, and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying he left no offspring. And the second took her, and he died, nor did he leave any offspring. And the third likewise. So the seven had her and left no offspring. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be? For all seven had her as a wife." Jesus answered and said to him, "Are you not therefore mistaken, because you do not know the scriptures nor the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But concerning the dead, that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush passage, how God spoke to him and saying, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. You are therefore greatly mistaken.'"
Okay, then Victor, if you will, Luke chapter 20, verses 37 through 39.
37,
you're right.
"Then came to him certain of the Sadducees, which deny that there is any resurrection, and they asked him, saying, 'Master, Moses wrote unto us, if any man's brother die, having a wife, and he die without children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. There were therefore seven brethren, and the first took a wife and died without children. The second took her wife, and he died childless. The third took her, and in like manner the seven also, they left no children and died. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrections, whose wife of them is she? For seven had her to wife. And Jesus answered and said unto them, 'The children of the world marry, and they are given in marriage, but they shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage. Neither can they die any more, for they are equal in angels, are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. So now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush that he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not a God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him.' And then certain of the scribes answered, saying, 'Master, thou hast well said.'"
Okay, thank you very much. All right. All right, we've got another group here, the Sadducees. Now, what are the beliefs of the Sadducees? They don't believe there's any resurrection. Now, there's something more behind that. Turn over to Acts chapter 23 and look at verse 8. Jeannie, would you get that for us, please? Acts chapter 23, verse 8. Okay, so the Pharisees were materialists. They didn't even believe in the existence of the spirit realm. Now, I don't have any idea how they believe in God and not believe in I'm not able to resolve that in my mind. Anybody here want to try to explain it to me? I don't know how you can believe in God and not believe in the existence of the spirit realm. But they did not believe that there was such a thing as spirits. Maybe it meant spirits of people, but they didn't believe in angels either. So they didn't believe in angelic beings either. Now, maybe they made an exception for the existence of God. I don't know. But we know from the scriptures that they actually were materialists. And so they're not believing in the resurrection was a part of a broader a lack of faith. What I read also that in, you know, there are passages, not just in this passage that Jesus quotes, that show from the Old Testament the existence of the spirit realm and of the resurrection. In Daniel chapter 12, Daniel plainly foretold the resurrection of the dead. Let me find, I don't have that passage in my notes, so let me get over there. It's Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. Harold, do you mind getting that for us? Pat's going to make sure you're not off the hook, Harold.
You said Daniel?
Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. And it's good to see you. Glad you're able to make it back. And so as a welcome to you, I'll put you on the spot and ask you to read.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
I thought you might.
And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt.
Do you think that's a pretty plain teaching of the resurrection of the dead?
Yes, it is.
I believe it is. So how did the Sadducees get around that?
Who knows?
Well, the answer is, they didn't believe that the Old Testament prophets were a part of the only books they accepted were the five books of Moses. And the rest of them they didn't believe were inspired of God. So they went to the opposite extreme from the Pharisees. The Pharisees not only accepted all of the Old Testament, what's called the canon of Scripture, the 39 books of our Old Testament, but they accepted the unwritten traditions handed down by the fathers as well, and would even put the traditions of the father above the script, just like Catholics still do to this day.
If they didn't believe that there was a resurrection, why would they even follow the Bible?
I don't have a clue. I wish I could give you a good answer on that, but I have the same question you do. The only thing I can see is that, remember,
here on earth.
Yeah, well, they did believe that, and the Old Testament does. The books of Moses do promise physical blessings on this earth if they obey God. So maybe, but at the same time, remember that the Old Testament was both political and spiritual. And so if they were going to have any political power, they're going to have to follow or claim to be followers of the God of the Old Testament. So, you know, that may be, or it may be they're just looking for the physical blessings, because that is true, that primarily what the Old Testament, particularly the books of Moses, promise are the physical blessings to national Israel if they will obey the Lord. At any rate, they're materialists. They didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And if Jesus had wanted to go to the prophets, like Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, I believe he could very plainly show them from the Old Testament scriptures that there is a resurrection, but would they have accepted it if Jesus had gone to Daniel? No. See, there's the problem. So he went to a part of the Bible that they claimed to accept, the books of Moses, and showed it to them from the books of Moses. Okay? But now before we go see where Jesus went to, the problem that they posed, somebody just relate to us the problem, the little what-if situation they proposed. What was the situation?
If a man married a wife and he died without children, his brother had to marry her.
Okay.
So the children, he could raise children in honor of him.
Right.
But there were seven brothers, and none of them got the job accomplished.
Okay.
After that third brother died, I don't think if I was that fourth brother, I'd have married
him. Well. But it was his obligation. I said, I'm gonna get on the Sorry about that. I'm going to get on the side of the Sadducees here. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 and 6. Sharon, would you read that for us? Deuteronomy chapter 25. Pat, you can't even keep your Bible, can you? Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 and 6.
There are usually Bibles here, so we got that.
Ah, okay. Well, there's some up here. You want me to bring them back a couple of them? I'll do that.
There's none back in here anywhere.
Well, shame on us. Look, that's a songbook. You don't want that.
What did you say, Keith?
Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 and 6.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. Fifth book of Moses.
If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel.
Okay. Now, the lot. By the way, notice, perform the duty of the brothers of the brother of any of the dead brother. But anyway, that goes all the way back. That was a tradition among the descendants of Abraham before the law was given. Judah had sons that did not perform that duty, and God killed them as the result. And so that was an ancient, and it had to do with the inheritance of the land. Remember that the land was inherited by the tribes and the families within the tribes. The father's the head of the family. It was a patriarchal system, so that the land was passed down from family or from father to son to grandson right on down. And so if a man died with no heir, then there was a land that would be ownerless. And so in order to make sure that they would always have people in family succession dwelling on the land, farming the land, then there's this law that if a brother died and had no heir, then his brother had to take that wife to himself and raise up children. The first one was counted as the heir of the dead brother. Okay, and by the way, the book of Ruth is based on, the whole book of Ruth is based on that law that God made. Ruth the Moabitess and her husband, and she became what, the great grandmother, I believe, of David, wasn't she? But at any rate, that was a very important Old Testament law. So all right, this problem then. Seven brothers and no heir. So in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? Do you know, and this is just an interesting thing I want to bring up, that there's a religious group today that cannot answer that question? It's the Mormons. They believe in eternal marriage. Marriage is in eternity after death if the marriage is performed in a temple, in a Mormon temple. The husband gives his wife a secret name. Now, talk about a patriarchal system. And she will not be able to be raised from the dead unless he calls her name. So, you wives better submit to your husbands. You're in a heap of trouble under the Mormon system. And I used that against a Mormon in debate and made a woman so mad she wanted to kill me. But because she was looking forward to eternal marriage to her husband. And I pointed out to her, well now, if you die, he can marry again. But if he dies, you can't marry again. You're eternally married. She didn't like that answer a bit in the world. But that is consistent with Mormon doctrine, their doctrine of eternal marriage. And by the way, this passage shows it's a false doctrine, doesn't it? Is marriage eternal or for this life? It's for this life. That's the point that Jesus, that's one point that Jesus made. And so they erred in their understanding of the scriptures, not realizing that marriage is only for this life. But how else did they err? Well, what about the resurrection of the dead? How did Jesus prove the resurrection of the dead?
By going to the scripture in Exodus about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, that's when the Lord appeared to Moses in the burning bush, who did he tell Moses he was? The God of
Abraham.
He said, I am, present tense, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then when Moses said, well, when I go to the children of Israel, that's Exodus 3 verse 6, isn't it? And then Exodus 3:15, when I go to the children of Israel, who shall I say sent me? Say, I am, and I am the God. Now notice, again, present tense, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now let me ask you, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were they dead or alive at the time that God appeared to Moses?
Dead.
They were dead. So if there is no spirit, did they exist or not exist? If there's no spirit, they would not have existed. And so God would be the God of nothing. The God of what did not exist. You see the point that Jesus... Now, I never would have thought of that. I guarantee I never would have thought of that. But Jesus went right to the heart of the matter. Is God the God of nothing?
No.
But he is present tense. The God of Abraham, Isaac... And by the way, that's still the case. What does that show concerning Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And all others who have died. Their spirits are still in existence. And in one sense, they're alive. They're in existence and they're conscious. Okay? And so that by itself, I want to go with one other point because we're about to run out of time. Why did Jesus say you do err not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God? Now we see how they didn't know the scriptures because even under the part of the scriptures that they accepted, it implies that there are spirit beings, that we have a spirit that continues to exist after our death. That's the implication. But why did they not know the power of God?
Because they didn't believe in the spirit part of it.
Well, and they didn't believe in the resurrection. Paul addresses this in 1 Corinthians 15. Some of the Christians in Corinth did not believe in bodily resurrection of the dead. And they posed a question, how can God... Somebody's been buried at sea. And the fish of the sea devour their body, and their body goes just, the physical parts of their body just go through all kinds of, you think about all the change. The fish that ate them died, and another fish eats them, and so forth. Now, how's God going to bring that all back together and raise those folks from the dead?
Because he's God.
You know what Paul called people that asked that question?
Foolish.
Fool. Yeah, he said foolish or fools. He called them fools for asking the question, because what it does is deny the power of God to do anything he wills. When I was in Kenya just last month, eating breakfast, and a fellow sat down with me, he was from Australia, and he's an atheist. And he wanted to know, well, how could God create the universe in 6 days? You know what I told him? The only problem that gives to me is why he waited 6 days and didn't do just like that. God's omnipotent. He's all-powerful. The guy gulped. He didn't have an answer to that. But if there's an omnipotent, all-powerful God, I frankly don't know why it took him 6 days. I guess because he chose to do it in 6 days. That's the only reason I can give. Okay, he could do it just like that and everything be here. But he didn't. And so that's just a foolish question if you believe in an all-powerful God, which I do.
So that disproves the Big Bang Theory. He didn't do it just like that.
Right, there you go. Go ahead, Harold.
Well, I was thinking that he put a little more wisdom into it. He was thinking about what he was doing while he was creating this. He didn't just decide, this is what I want.
Well, I have no doubt you're right, Harold. But there may be a deep philosophical reason for 6 days, but I don't know what it is. Okay? James?
I had a man, an atheist, arguing with me one time that there was no way that... they could have got that many animals on the ark.
And again, that's a foolish statement. for so many, first of all, it was a miracle. That's the main thing. And second, the people don't know the size of that ark. That was the biggest boat ever built before the 20th century. It was a humongous thing. And of course, they think we had to get these full-grown brontosaurus and all that stuff. Well, I wouldn't go into all that. But at any rate, that's just a foolish question. Then people bring up nonsense like that. And the foolhardiness of it is easy to demonstrate. All right, we're out of time. We're going to Jesus answered their question, and they could not deal with his answers. And even those who were not of the scribes and Sadducees, excuse me, were amazed by his answer. All right, we'll move on to the next confrontation next time.
Ready now, please.